Good afternoon. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Today, on All Hallows' Eve, we'll be discussing one of, if not our greatest fear, death, and how our current cultural behaviors and beliefs surrounding the inevitable end of life actually work against our mental health and emotional well-being. We work very hard to distance ourselves from death, as if we can somehow prevent our own death if we refuse to think about or address its inevitability. Ironically, it's all of these efforts we make to protect ourselves from the grim reality of death that actually intensify the fear and devastation associated with death. It may just be that our cultural efforts to deny death are the greatest contributors to making death our biggest fear. So how appropriate, on the scariest night of the year, that we will taunt the Grim Reaper and dare to talk about death and how we've created our current rituals and coping methods. Halloween was originally intended to be a way to culturally acknowledge death and was intended to be an opportunity to make peace with departed souls and remember loved ones. Halloween got its start as a holiday with ancient roots that had a much greater meaning than this boisterous, costume-filled holiday that we know today. Around 2,000 years ago, the Celts who lived in what is now the United Kingdom, Ireland, and northern France had a festival commemorating the end of the year. Their new year was November 1st, and this festival was called Samhain. The end of the year signaled the end of summer and the end of the harvest season and the beginning of a long, hard winter that often caused many deaths of animals and people. Weaker livestock were often killed and eaten during this holiday, since most likely they would not survive the winter anyway. Because of this and the cruel winter to come, this time of year signified death to the pagan Celtics. They believed the night before the new year, the wall between the living and the dead was open, allowing the spirits of the dead, both good and bad, to mingle among the living. Some of these spirits were thought to possess living people, cause trouble, ruin crops, or search for passage to the afterlife. The Christian church reportedly did not like the festival with pagan roots practiced by Christians, so a replacement holiday was needed, which was how we came to find All Saints' Day, which was sanctioned by the church and related to the dead. In the United States, Halloween was really not a popular observance in early history, as most of the early settlers were Protestant. At the time, Halloween was considered mostly a Catholic, Episcopalian, and pagan holiday, and therefore was largely ignored. But by the mid-1800s, immigration increased, and many Irish immigrants, mostly Catholics fleeing the potato famine, brought many Halloween traditions with them. By the mid-20th century, Halloween turned into a secular holiday, community-centered with parties, city-wide parades, and great costumes. So Halloween in the U.S. today has moved away from its traditional roots as a way to acknowledge the inevitability of death and is now more focused on candy and costumes. But in many parts of the world, October 31st is still celebrated as a traditional focus, like Día de los Muertos, Day of the Dead, in Mexico and Latin America. Today, I'm fortunate to have in the studio Dr. Ned Schultz, who is an expert on the topic of death and dying and how we are culturally conditioned to shy away from the topic of death. Welcome, Dr. Schultz.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. Dr. Schultz is on the faculty at Cal Poly. He's been part of the Psychology and Child Development Department for 35 years. You have a PhD in developmental psychology with a focus on an interest in lifespan.
That's correct.
So tell me how you got interested in death.
Well, as a developmental psychologist, I'm interested in the changes in growth and development across the lifespan and all the way through to the end of the lifespan. So death is a natural part of developmental psychology in that sense. And about 20 years ago, I inherited the opportunity to teach the course on death and dying at Cal Poly, and it's just become a very strong interest of mine.
So you have you had a personal interest to begin with, and then had the opportunity to teach the class.
Yes.
All right. So tell me a little bit about the history of death and dying in our culture compared to present day.
Mm-hmm. Well, things have changed drastically in America. If you think about the lives of our ancestors, my ancestors came in the mid-1800s, as you were mentioning, and death was pretty much a do-it-yourself affair for them. At the time of the Civil War, death changed quite a bit because for the first time death was happening away from home. And people wanted the bodies of young men who died in the war to be brought home. And that's when we started embalming on a more modern scale so bodies could be preserved and brought home and people could see the body, interact with the body, and take care of it themselves.
So before that, when you say do it yourself, you mean literally people died at home and were buried at home?
Right. Pretty much people took care of the dead themselves. Mm-hmm. Growing up in a family in 200 years ago, you would know all about that. You would have seen people die at home. You would have seen your family taking care of the dead. And it really would have been much more normalized. Mm-hmm. The Civil War brought on experts, embalmers. You get to the turn of the century then with the rise of hospitals. We have more experts taking over, medical experts. Mm-hmm. And gradually, over time, death has really become something that we don't know about. We don't do ourselves. We've turned it over to experts. It's become much more complex. Death these days is a very complex medical experience. You have to know a lot about what's going on. And it takes place away from home, in institutions that are unfamiliar to us, a little intimidating. And it's just become easy to be distanced from death, alienated from death, because of these cultural changes.
So what you said was something about hospitals rising in our culture. So we didn't always have hospitals that people went to when they were sick and ailing.
Right. Yeah.
So how did that change death for us, having the opportunity to go to a hospital? How did that change how we thought about death?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, hospitals are, you know, somewhat alien to us. We don't always feel comfortable there. They're not quite like our homes. The people who work there know things that we don't know. They have expertise. And so it's easy to feel disconnected from what's going on. It's easy to feel uncomfortable, frightened, overwhelmed by the experience. And you may even be unnecessary or a hindrance to what's going on. In the old days, we banned family members because of the fear they brought germs into hospitals, too. So it really changed dying from a family home-like experience into a more institutional thing. 150 years ago, 80% of us died at home. These days, it's closer to 80% dying in institutions. That's quite a big difference.
Yeah. So did we somehow start to believe that if we went to a hospital, we would delay death or prevent death? Was there more acceptance of death prior to this idea that we could go to a hospital and get better?
Mm-hmm. Well, the causes of death changed too, and that was in part due to hospitals and medical advances, medicine, things like that. 150 years ago, we died fairly quick deaths. We died of strokes or heart attacks or pneumonia, things like that. Maybe a few days or a few weeks at most. These days, you can linger for a long time because of the benefits of medicine. There are all sorts of treatments. Death these days is months, sometimes years, where you know you're addressing something and fighting it off. So medicine has changed the type of death that we experience. Death these days is much more long-term and slow motion. And really, you don't feel like you're dying the whole time either. I mean, I remember when my father was dying, he died of chronic leukemia. But for 10 years, he was fine. He knew he had leukemia. There weren't really many treatments for it. And so we live with it in a very different way these days. And it opens up interesting possibilities. I mean, when you can be aware and you can think about it, you have the opportunity to consider death and the impact of mortality in your life and make choices about how you want to approach something like that, where you want to be. So it's an interesting time, but it's quite different than our history of dealing with death.
It seems like, because just thinking about how the origination of looking at all, you know, Hallows Eve, and seemed like a very pragmatic look at life and death, where, you know, as you knew livestock or people wouldn't make it through the winter, that you would kill off the livestock and eat it. And it just seemed like this whole idea of birth and death was, there wasn't a lot of nuanced gray area where we're going to think about it or approach it slowly.
Yes. I think very seasonal, very tied to the seasons, and it is more clear cut. Whereas dying these days is not clear-cut. I mean, it's stretched out. There is really a kind of an uncertain status while you're seeking treatment, while you're trying to delay death. You can live for many years quite happily with a very serious illness, and that's different. So it is more gray, I think, in that way.
So I guess it would make it more of a challenge then to prepare people for death. Like, how, you know, we feel so uncomfortable talking about it, just saying death out loud over and over again. You know, the two of us just saying this, death and dying. It still feels a little frightening just to say it, as if I say it, I'm going to catch it somehow. So how have all the changes in how we approach death made us feel uncomfortable or alienated us from death?
Yes. It is tricky. You when you have more time, when death takes more time, and you feel well enough to live your life, do you want to tell that to other people, you know, that I have leukemia, or which is a fatal illness? Do I want to say that? Mm-hmm. Do I want to change my life in some way, or do I want to try to ignore that and live as fully as I can? It's a dilemma. I can approach it and try to become comfortable with it and try to become at peace with it, talk about it more openly with my family or my friends. It's also tempting to try to control it by not talking about it, denying it, and trying to live in that sense as fully as you can without dealing with it. But of course, that sets up complications too. If your partner wants to talk about it and you don't, or if your kids need to talk about it and you want to deny it, it sets up a lot of complications for people, I think.
So why do you think what is our fear about talking about death? You know, is it something as simple as I don't want to talk about it because I might catch it, or I don't want to be around people who are dying because I might catch? I mean, is it that simple, or is there more to it? Have we been taught in our culture that we can live forever? I mean, we talk about extending life and people can, you know, living to 120. I mean, are we changing our expectations of life to being an idea that we don't have to ever die?
it seems that way. And, of course, we have made incredible changes in average life expectancy. I mean, it was 45 years 150 years ago. Now it's 78 to 80. So it's not an unrealistic expectation that we're trying to live longer in that regard. So some denial and pushing it away and fighting against death is a part of wanting to live more, wanting to live as full a life as we can, I suppose. There are a lot of people who think death is morbid in the sense that it could depress you, upset you, create anxiety in thinking about it. And so I think some people avoid it or don't want to talk about it for fear that it is upsetting or depressing either to themselves or to other people, too. And there's kind of an American toughness that we admire. I can get through this without talking about it. I can get through this without being overly sensitive. And sometimes we're afraid of our emotions, afraid of what will happen if my children see me crying or see me upset. We want to be strong for other people, too. So it raises a lot about our personalities, our philosophy of living, spiritual issues. And given that we have so much time to think about it these days, too, because of the type of death and the treatments, it's a bigger challenge for us. We have a lot more time to work with it creatively. We have a lot more time to suffer if it's problematic for us, too. So it's a very interesting challenge psychologically, I think.
So what are some of the psychological kind of tolls that we pay by denying that death is the inevitable? I mean, because I think that's the thing that is the unspoken truth, is that it is inevitable. We will die, and that we spend, you know, and I guess I've heard people say, well, we don't want to focus on dying while we're living. We want to live while we live. Mm-hmm. But what is the emotional or psychological toll we pay ultimately for not really facing that as being the end of life?
Yes, I think there are two really that come to my mind. One is that issue of toughness to sensitivity. There's kind of a continuum that we can all choose just in our everyday lives about death or about other things as well. You can tilt toward being tough and hardened about life, or you can tilt toward being more sensitized to it, more open to feeling it. And I think one toll of denying death and closing it off, not talking about it, not being willing to talk about it is kind of this artificial toughness. So you toughen yourself, and that toughening may block you from having other emotional experiences that are meaningful or important. There are things we want to be sensitive to in life. Mm-hmm. It's hard just to turn on your sensitivity at certain times and turn it off at others. When you toughen yourself overall too much, you carry that hide with you mm-hmm. into almost every situation. So I think that's one risk. And then the second is kind of a diffuse anxiety. Okay. When we don't talk about important things that are real, that are definitely there, there's this uncomfortable tension, I think, that's just below the surface, maybe, where if I say the wrong thing to you, if I know you're coping with something, or there's an illness in your life or your family or somewhere, there's just this tension. So it makes us hard to have authentic interactions with each other, hard to talk even just in day-to-day conversation. You know, there's pretense because I'm worried that I'm going to upset you, or I'm worried that you're going to notice something about me. If my body is changing because I'm being treated for cancer, I'm nervous that people are going to notice that or maybe be offended by something that has changed. So I think another price is this anxiety about just living and interacting with other people. If we could talk about death more comfortably, that might drop or decrease to some extent.
So that seems to be one of the prices we paid moving from home death to separating out to experts who come in and get the body, and funeral homes and undertakers and embalming, that they just pushed us farther and farther away from actually interacting with the body or the departed person. And how are some of the rituals and cultural practices that are available today? Like I started off talking about Dia de los Muertos. How do those rituals and cultural practice help us deal with death in a better way?
Mm-hmm. The rituals often teach us acceptable ways of interacting with each other about death. They model appropriate behaviors. They kind of channel our urge to do something into socially acceptable directions. So from that standpoint, they can be helpful in supporting people when you don't really know what to do, if you are somewhat alienated or confused. There's a danger that the rituals aren't right for you individually. So that's a risk that we run when certain religions or ethnic groups have particular rituals. They may be a little confining for some people. So they don't always work in that sense. But they can help. We go through them together. They kind of are patterns that we can mimic from each other. And sometimes there's a comfort in doing that.
So there is no uniform death practice in our culture, it seems, except for the idea that someone comes to our home and picks up the body and takes it to the funeral home. And is that the law that we all have to follow?
Well, laws about body disposal actually vary quite a bit from city to city. They often are left to local jurisdictions because of differences in living conditions, urban versus rural, and things like that. There are basic guidelines, you know, that we all follow. The basic issue is you do have to dispose of the body, and there are public health concerns about things like that, too. But really, I think what's happened is, like many things in our lives, we've shifted to experts. We want experts to take care of these things for us. We want to get it done right. We also don't always have the time and energy to do everything. I mean, things like plumbing and roofing and things like that, too.
So we throw death in there, too.
That's right.
Bring in the expert.
So we like experts. There's a comfort in having experts to call in a moment like that, I think.
But I wonder if there isn't more mental health benefits if we were to actually relate with and be with.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's the problem with medical experts, too. When you interact with them, you get the facts, you get the quick input, but you can't have a deep conversation, and they don't have time to process your feelings and things like that. So we have lost a lot in that sense, where if we were handling these things as families, as friends, we would have the time to support each other, to talk. You might have more time with the body, dressing the body, preparing the body at home. a chance to interact. That's very useful psychologically. It helps you to see that the person and the body are not exactly the same thing, and that the psyche, the person, the soul, whatever, however you think of it, is now separate from the body, and that can help in letting go of the body in that sense. So I think we have lost some of that. There's a cost in having experts handling it for us.
So is there an approach we could use towards death now that would be more natural, more accepting? I mean, is there an idea that a good death is possible?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who think we have to make some changes, that we've gone too far with kind of the medical imperatives and institutional control of death. And a lot of people think psychologically we'd be better off dying with our loved ones around us, if that's possible. So the good death movement thinks about ways in which death could be more integrated into our lives. When you talk to people who are dying, they are concerned about dignity, privacy, comfort in their surroundings, familiarity, and things like that. So that speaks to being at home or to being in your living environment. So I think that's an issue that we think about a lot. Perhaps giving more control to people or giving more choice about how much of this medical imperative we're going to use or at what point we're going to make a change in that. The medical institution can take over pretty quickly at times, and of course we defer to their expertise, but at points there are choices that might be better made by family or by the dying person. So I think in that sense a lot of people are thinking, could we shift our approach to death? And programs like hospice, the hospice movement, are all kind of geared toward that question of what is the good death, given that we're wrestling with it in new ways these days.
Why do we fear death so much? I mean, what is it that drives that fear, our greatest fear?
Mm-hmm. When you survey people about that, the number one thing they say is separation from others. They fear the loss of the attachments to other people.
The person who's dying or the people who've lost the person to death?
Well, when we survey people, most of the time we're talking to people who are living and thinking about the people that they have lost. So it's an attachment issue in that sense. We're anxious about our attachments with others, and it's not unlike the anxiety we feel when our children move away or when our families live in different parts of the country and our friends aren't immediately with us. So that's a big part of it, resolving our feelings about being separate from others, feeling secure even if they're not with us at the time. There's a phrase that's used often in regard to death and dying, which is this question of continuing bonds with the dead. Mm-hmm. Can you have a continuing bond with someone when they're gone? And so psychologically or emotionally, how can you do that? I think that's a nice way of thinking about addressing the attachment or the separation issue. Whatever your religious or spiritual or philosophical views are, we all have to wrestle with this question of where did the person go? Mm-hmm. Where did the person go? Where did his or her energies
go? If they're not in that body, because clearly when we look at a dead body, the psyche and soul are not there.
Right, so yes. And so if you can resolve that in your mind somehow, where did their energy go? Where is their essence? That may help reduce that anxiety about separation from them and the fear of death that comes from that.
So what is some of the work that people need to do internally to prepare themselves to die?
Well, the biggest work really is separating from life, in a sense, psychologically, I mean, realizing that you can't continue with a lot of the things that you've been doing, that you have to let go. You have to let go of activities, relationships. You're not going to be able to maintain your life the same way. So there is a letting go process that can be gradual. I think it's a creative possibility for us, given that our deaths are drawn out now where we have a lot of time. You can think about that. You can think of gradually retiring from life in a sense. And what can you let go to simplify your life a little bit? Or what's the essence of your life that you need to hold on to until the end? So in that sense, people need help and support in kind of the letting go that's going to be a part of gradually fading from full life in that sense. And that's not to say that you can't really enjoy your last days, but it may be that life shrinks down a little bit and you gradually let go in that sense.
So how does life review, the life review process, fit into that? Does that need to be a formal thing that people tell another person their life story?
Mm-hmm. That's an important way that we do it. Life review, of course, is just thinking, realizing that there is an endpoint for you, realizing, 10 years maybe is what I have. And so then thinking of the lifespan and what you've done with your time, trying to make sense of it. And often that involves telling your story to others, writing your story, videotaping your story perhaps, trying to make new sense of it, trying to tell it in a way that has meaning for you and in a way that hopefully you'll feel at peace with, so you don't have to fight death as much when your time comes. If you can look back at your life and feel content with the arc of your life, mm-hmm. and the way you used your time, maybe it's not as hard to accept death at that point.
So at what point in someone's life, then, does a life review begin? I mean, does it always have to be when you know death is inevitable, or is there a point in our lives that we can start doing a life review? And
I think you can do it earlier without a terminal diagnosis. And in a sense, you just have to start thinking of time slightly in a different way, not how much time have I lived? How old am I? But maybe how much time do I have left, realistically? And how do I feel about the time that I have lived coupled with the time that I have left? So as you start seeing that there is a horizon, or if you start admitting to yourself that there is a point on the horizon there, you can reflect on kind of your journey to that point and what needs to be done, what needs to be fixed in the journey, apologies or whatever it might be. And in that sense, it doesn't take death to cause you to do that. You could do that at almost any time, I think, in adulthood. When you've lived a certain amount, at least, you can start thinking about the quality of your life and how you've used it and how much time you have.
So it sounds like if we can integrate the act of dying with our act of living, we can somehow have this harmonious relationship with the experience, in best case. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, hospice is a great resource. And I really appreciate you coming in today to talk to us. Thank you for joining us for a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett with Issues and Ideas. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.